Welcome to the Hands in Motion podcast, brought to you by the American Society of Hand Therapists. Here we will discuss all things upper extremity therapy, from assessment to treatment, the latest research, the patient experience, and other topics related to the field of upper extremity rehab. Learn more and subscribe today at asht.org.
This episode of Hands in Motion is sponsored by the Indiana Hand to Shoulder Center, a private hand surgery and hand therapy practice recognized across the world for its specialization in problems and injuries of the upper extremity. The Indiana Hand to Shoulder Center is hosting a conference this May. Hand Care 2024 is geared towards the practicing clinician with a special interest in hand and upper extremity rehabilitation, with the goal of advancing the practice of hand therapy and quality of patient care. This three-day course includes lectures, research, anatomy and orthotics labs, panel discussions with therapists and surgeons, state-of-the-art exhibits, and of course, some fun. Join us May 16th through the 18th in Noblesville, Indiana. For more information and to register for the conference, visit our website at www.handcareconference.com. Welcome back to another episode of Hands in Motion. On this episode, we are joined by Emily Hartnett, an occupational therapist and certified hand therapist who has turned her hobby of rock climbing into a specialty area of practice. She shares with us common injuries sustained by rock climbers and unique aspects of caring for this patient population. Welcome to Hands in Motion, Emily.
So we're here with Emily. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into treating the type of injuries that you do and what kind of things you do with them.
So I became an OT. I think I got my license in 2019 and became a CHT in 2022. And I've been rock climbing since 2017, I think. So when I went to OT school, I was a climber on the side, but I never intended or planned on combining it. And then as I started my hours for the CHT exam, I was also climbing and had a lot of climbing patients because I'm in Denver, Colorado, and just coincidentally combined the two. And then after I got my CHT, I went back for my doctorate to research under-researched climbers' injuries and have built my practice mainly off of that.
So what are some of the typical injuries that you see in rock climbers?
Most of them are strain injuries. It's actually rarely anything traumatic or post-op. The biggest repetitive strain ones are tennis and golfer's elbow, and then pulley strain injuries are probably the three biggest that I see.
So for our listeners who might not be into rock climbing, talk us through some of the mechanics and what this activity, and I think it's even a sport, and there's competitions and whatnot, but how that can ultimately lead to some of these overuse injuries.
The way they use their hands is really unique. There's not any other occupation I can think of, at least, that consistently weight bears on their hands in positions that climbers do. So one of the most common positions in climbing is called a crimp grip, which is the same thing as an intrinsic minus. So it would be like making an intrinsic minus hand and then doing essentially a pull-up or weight bearing on it. So it's a lot of force on smaller joints. It's also contracting a lot of muscles we wouldn't normally use most functional hand grips. Elbow injuries are big as well because we're using those tendons in a unique way. We're weight bearing on long tendons in our wrists and elbows, which causes the repetitive strain injuries. Most of climbing is we have an intrinsic minus or intrinsic plus hand, usually intrinsic minus if it's a more advanced climber. And our elbows are typically straight, almost locked straight. A lot of what I do is telling people not to lock their elbows straight. That's how you'd think you would climb.
So are the patients that you're mostly seeing, are these indoor rock climbing where you might go to a gym, or we had a rock climbing wall in my college rec center, or this also to the extreme of these are people rock climbing outside? I've been visiting a bunch of national parks and they talk about people rock climbing up Half Dome at Yosemite and all these massive rocks at these national parks. Are you seeing both of these types of patients?
A pretty good combination, probably. Being in Denver, Colorado, it's a little unique because our weather is very unpredictable. Today it was 75 degrees, but it's supposed to be snowing in a couple hours. So a lot of people that do climb outside, they're also climbing inside. Right now it's more of an indoor season. People do still climb outside, but they're not going as hard, for lack of a better term, as they do in the summer and fall seasons. Most competitive climbers, people that compete, like the competitions I think you were referencing earlier, that's always inside. So a lot of those people that are higher up will stay inside just to avoid less predictable environment by climbing outside. That's probably only like 25% of my caseload. I made that number up. That feels right. The rest of them definitely are mostly outside, season dependent.
And do you see a difference between injuries from indoor to outdoor climbing?
Sometimes, yes. A lot more lumbrical involvement in the outdoor climbing. I do both. I prefer outside, but again, just like on weeknights and weather dependent, I climb inside instead. When I'm outside, I'm more nervous, for lack of a better term. So I'll death crimp or death grip things. Whereas inside, if I fall, I'm falling onto a padded gym floor or I'm with a friend that has caught me multiple times. I think that's part of why indoor injuries are a little different indoor versus outdoor. Also, the competition climbers, their injuries are often a little bit different than the non-competition climbers. When people are training to compete, they're doing the same climbs over and over again. So the performance patterns are pretty much exactly the same with very minor tweaks here and there. Whereas outdoor, once we finish one climb, we're typically moving on to another climb. If we're not, if it's a climb that's a little bit harder and we're more advanced at climbing, we call it projecting, where I'm doing something that's past my pay grade. I'm doing something that's a little bit too hard for me, but it's my project, quote unquote, meaning I'm trying to complete it in a certain amount of time. That's usually done outdoor. It can be done indoor. It's not as common. When I see that, that's also a petri dish for the repetitive strain injuries because we're doing the exact same thing over and over, usually all day, sometimes multiple days. We also like to camp here.
So once you get these patients in the clinic, typical assessment, what does that look like? If you're looking for anything specific that they're looking to do, yes, you have the repetitive type stuff, but what are you looking for? What treatment are you looking to do as well?
It definitely depends a little bit. A lot of what I do is typical to a standard non-rock climber hand therapy evaluation. Times that it's different, one that strikes at TFCC injuries are a lot different in climbers because they're using their wrists so uniquely. Usually their rehab's a little bit longer than a non-climbing patient. Also, if they had a post-op condition or trauma, I always treat it the same as anyone else. The repetitive strain injuries are a little bit different because all of their goals are to go back and do the exact same thing. And it's a little bit hard to do an ergonomic adjustment for climbing because there's really not much at all that's ergonomic about climbing. So that's probably the main difference in treating climbers versus non-climbers. So evaluation-wise, if they can, I ask them to bring in a video of them climbing. If they're projecting, I want a video of the project so I can see the exact performance pattern that they're doing over and over again. If it's a strain injury from climbing in general, I just want to see how they're climbing. Sometimes it's something as simple as like a shoulder or elbow position. Other times I can also see when they're death crimping. I'm sure there's a better word for it. If I see them doing that, we try to correct it. And then I do use standard tools. I use a dynamometer and putty quite a bit. For example, if someone's crimping too hard, like I feel like they're pinching harder than they need to weight bear, I'll go with them to the gym, or I have a gym set up in my office. We'll put putty on the hold or rock that we call the rocks hold. And they'll see when they weight bear into the crimp grip on the putty, they'll see that the putty is going into the rock. They'll be able to see rock in the indents. And using that as a visual is a good way to train less of a death crimp again. Other things for projects, I really can't ergonomically adjust them, and all of their goals are to complete it. Most of them, if I tell them that they have to stop, they just won't see me again. They'll continue and push through the pain and won't seek medical advice. So what we normally do instead is try to find a way where they can imitate that climb without actually doing the climb. So usually that's in my office. I can take the rocks I have on and off and reposition them. We can do that. I can't change things in the gym. They don't let me, but we can do that in my office on a smaller scale and then train their position so that their hand position is absolutely perfect for when they go back outside. That's kind of the way I found to make it a little bit easier. When I started, a lot of them just weren't coming back because I told them that I couldn't do things. That's not what they want to hear. And most of them are so advanced and into it that they would rather have a little bit of pain or even a moderate amount of pain and get through it and worry about it later.
That's interesting that you say that when you first started, you were telling people to stop and they weren't coming back. And I think we've probably all been guilty of that before. What changed in the way you deliver that information to these patients, or have you changed your practice or your mindset with these patients so that they are coming back and they are seeking your services and you are able to help them and keep them in this activity?
It's been a little bit tricky to combine. I think I'm better at it now. But instead, I try to do absolutely everything I can before we take a break or something similar to a break. So breaking up the climb into smaller pieces, like I said, in my office, or tools in the gym, if it's adaptable to the gym, I'll go with them to the gym and we can do things there. There's also ways to train climbing. They have tools such as a tension block or hangboard, which is essentially a hangboard is similar to a pull-up bar, I guess, in that it suspends from a doorway, usually in someone's home. And it has different sized holds that we can crimp on. So having perfect posture on those holds would translate to climbing in the real world, which would make their project a lot easier and also would take away some of that repetitive strain piece. Other things is just better preparing ourselves to climb. A lot of them really don't warm up at all or think that they're warming up, and it's not what I would define as a warm up. So a lot of what I do is also redefining how they're warming up. A big part of that is stretching. A lot of them are really into their grip strength. A lot of them actually buy their own dynamometers off of Amazon and repeatedly, obsessively test their own grip strength. So also kind of trying to change that mental need, I guess. I don't know what I would call that, that we don't really need that much grip strength. I mean, we do need grip strength, but not what they're thinking to climb. And we need a lot more flexibility and endurance than I think they realize. So a lot of it is education and then breaking up those really repetitive climbs that they're trying to do.
I learned quickly after a session or two in college climbing the endurance piece. And you want to be up there and you want to be on the wall and you want to be climbing. And then you realize, oh my goodness, my arms are tired. My legs are tired. It's more of an endurance sport than you would think. You just think, oh, I'm going to climb to the top and be done. But it might take you a little longer than you think.
It's definitely mostly endurance. Other people can muscle their way through some things. I probably can't. But yeah, it's definitely more beneficial to have the endurance piece in most cases.
So what task-specific strengthening do you do? I know you said you mentioned about working and holding on to some of the grips in your clinic, but what exercise tasks would you have somebody work on to further improve their strength?
I'm really into intrinsic stretching. In addition to warm-up things, I almost always add intrinsic stretching and then the forearm stretches to prevent or delay tennis elbow or golfer's elbow. There's also often a large imbalance between extrinsic and intrinsic strength in climbers' hands because they use their lumbricals, I think, a little bit more intensely than most people do. So it's calming that down and then strengthening the extrinsic, so FTP mostly, usually with putty. Sometimes I'll change it up. A lot of them also scoff at putty. It looks a little silly because it's pink and pretty. But convincing them that putty is useful is a big one. I also really like the flex bars. I think they're TheraBand brand flex bars. Those are a big one also to prevent or delay the elbow conditions. So a lot of them I would see in like a normal clinic or a non-climber patient clinic. We just slightly change things to make it a little bit more relevant. In terms of tools, I really only use putty or the gym itself or those other two tools I mentioned earlier, the tension block and the hangboard. Usually things that they already have in their home also, besides putty. None of them have putty, but I give a lot of them putty.
How do you translate for someone who is doing more climbing outside? I mean, I have a very small knowledge of rock climbing, but I've seen walls and I've seen then rock walls outside and they look nothing alike. How do you translate? You don't have those holds. You don't have the different shaped tiny rocks bolted to the wall when you go out and you've got a flat wall of rock. How do you translate from the clinic, from your gym, from their gym, for someone who is going outside and changing that up, how do you make that transition?
It definitely is very different. The holds look a lot different, but they're more similar than I think we think they are. What's mostly different is the density and texture, actually, of the holds. If you talk to a climber, they'll probably obsess over something called limestone, which is just like a nicer rock to hold, essentially. So the biggest part to translate is actually like a proprioceptive piece. Back to my death crimping, when we're training on indoor, those holds aren't as dense as real rock is. So when we go outside, we're sensing, I guess, through our body that it feels different and subconsciously just gripping a lot harder than we intend to. Actually, I have a spike in patients around this time, maybe in a couple more weeks, it'll be a little bit higher because everyone's been training inside for a couple months and now we're trying to go outside. That's when I see a lot of injury because we're all gripping way harder than we're used to because we're outside now and the rock is different. And again, they're overusing their lumbricals. The lumbricals are one of our most proprioceptive muscles in our hand, at least, which we need for climbing to sense what and where and when we're doing things. So if they're fatigued from me death gripping on things, I'm also going to lose that kind of sense piece. So that change in texture and density is a lot more significant than I think we realize when we're training inside for a long time.
So how do you train that proprioceptive or that feedback, knowing that if someone is in the winter training indoors, how do you prepare them to go back outside, do you include proprioceptive activities into your treatment plan?
I always try to put a little bit of weight bearing, or at least like into the joint, at least with their warmups when I redesign their warmups with them. Also, something we do is trying to bring attention to how strong they're gripping things. Ways I do that actually look a little bit silly, to be honest, but I have them hold the dynamometer and try to keep the dial in the same spot while I ask them to jog in place or something kind of silly like that, so that they can start sensing how hard or not hard they're actually squeezing things, for lack of a better term. Crimping is probably a better term. Same on the hangboard. I do things with a scale so that they're perceiving their body weight, perceiving how much they're weight bearing on their hands by their body weight. So for example, I have a hangboard in my clinic above a body weight scale. So I'll take their body weight and tell them to offload. So put weight into both of their hands to what they think is 50% of their body weight. None of them are ever correct, but it's a fun game. And most of them can usually get there in a couple sessions. And that also helps with that translation when they're training indoor and outdoor. It also helps prevent injury because it takes away that piece where they're, again, death crimping things. And also helps with that proprioceptive sense in general. A lot of climbing is pretty dynamic. They're moving pretty quickly. And sometimes they're seemingly flying. They're staying on one limb, so one point of contact, whether it be a foot or a hand. And they have to catch things fairly quickly without necessarily looking at it. So that proprioception also helps a decent amount.
If people are climbing outside, there's going to be a drastic change in temperature. Could be colder, could be warmer. And I know that has a definite impact on your ability to sense how much you're gripping. I know I did industry work for a long time, and that was one of the important things that we had to remember was, okay, is the warehouse they're working in 50 degrees or is it 75 degrees? And a lot of times in the cold, people over grip because the hands are cold, so they're not getting normal sensation. Is there anything you recommend or suggest to your patients or clients with varying temperatures?
It's actually a really good point. I've been looking for an answer for this one. So if you have advice, I'll gladly take it. Another concern with living in Colorado is the rock is almost always freezing cold unless it's directly in the sun. And the temperature itself isn't necessarily cold. So when we're standing on the ground and then moving to the rock, it's usually a big difference, which also, as you said, changes that proprioceptive piece and that need to grip harder. So that's why I've been emphasizing all I've been doing currently is emphasizing warming up and stopping between each climb or even in the middle of the climb if it's safe enough to warm up again. So to stretch intrinsics, they call them finger rolls, which is tendon glides, anything like that to increase blood flow, because it is definitely a concern, especially with the rock itself being so cold. And the temperature here also definitely drastically varies. Again, it's 75 today and snowing tonight, supposedly.
Gloves aren't really an option because you need that input to be able to hold on to the rock, obviously. I would recommend an industry setting gloves, but again, that it only works for a certain period of time because then they're losing, again, proprioceptive input with anything that they're doing. So
in between, they would help. I tried hand warmers that you wear when you ski or snowboard, but then people were concerned that their palms were too sweaty, which takes away from friction also. So we put chalk on our hands to increase the friction. And when that gets sweaty, we usually have to wipe off all the sweat and re-dip in chalk. So it was working, but not really that well.
Are there, along the lines of the gloves, you don't want to lose that sensory input to their hands. Are there any orthotic interventions or any sort of assistive devices that are helpful in either preventing some of these injuries or assisting and allowing people to return to these activities while they're still experiencing symptoms that don't get in the way of the actual activity?
The only ones I really use so far are usually I'm not immobilizing or supporting the joint in any way. It'd be pulley rings, wrist widgets, and bandits. So kind of counterforce and protective and preventative, but not in the way of any range of motion and not constricting anything. Even the pulley rings, a lot of them don't want to wear them because they constrict the finger. Even when we're not injured, our fingers swell when we climb because of how much weight we're putting on them. So pulley rings after 4 or 5 routes are a little too tight usually. I've tried to tell people to wear them anyway and elevation and move around, take a break. Most of them don't want to do that. So yeah, working on that still. But pulley rings, bandits, and wrist widgets are probably the only ones I recommend currently that I can think of, in addition to normal K and dynamic taping.
Do you utilize that supportive taping or taping for feedback as a reminder? Do you utilize that for this patient population?
Taping, I definitely do. Taping is definitely something they're also more on board with. So I do a lot of taping. I use the dynamic tape brand most of the time, if you're familiar. So it's a four-way stretch instead of the two-way stretch, which is really good feedback for the wrists and thumbs specifically. I do find myself using those usually more than K-tape.
So have you ever experienced having a patient come in for tendonitis? They go through a couple of treatments. They do not come back because you tell them to rest. And then they have to return back with a more severe injury, or even, I don't know if you can rupture tendons at any point, but has that ever happened?
It happens frequently. To the point, usually when I don't use people's names, obviously, but when I have a new patient, I usually reference one of those people. One of them did. He went a little bit too intensely with his climbing and he ended up increasing his injury to a mallet finger. The one I usually reference often just to kind of tell people not to do that. But usually when I tell them instead of taking a break, when we adapt it to a certain extent, they're usually more okay with it. Also now there's a little bit of a shift in the community or culture, I would say, where they're more readily accepting medical advice. There was a study done in, I think, 2017 or around then, where they surveyed climbers in somewhere in California, and 21% of them said that they wouldn't ever, under any circumstance, seek medical advice because they were certain, quote unquote, that we would tell them to stop climbing, which also I think of that a lot. So moving away from that, I think, especially as like occupational therapists focusing on an occupation, that seems to be a shift in both our world and their world. So they're a little bit more open to it. I definitely see a difference when I have a younger patient in a different generation than the older generations. The younger generations are a little bit more accepting and willing to try things, whereas the older generations still seem to have a little bit of a stigma about it. But it is interesting. I feel like it's getting easier. I don't know if that's a cultural shift or if I'm just getting better at explaining things. Not sure which one. Hopefully a combination, but I don't know.
You mentioned generations. What is the age range that you are seeing these climbers?
You would be shocked.
Well, I figured with you saying that. So I'm curious.
My oldest was 77 and he was still actively rock climbing, but he was a bit of an outlier. Besides him, he's the only person that I've had that was a climber on Medicare. So everyone else, I should actually check my records. Everyone else had to be below the age of 64, but no one's been quite in his age range. Everyone else, my average patient is probably in their 30s and it probably goes as high to later 50s minus that one outlier.
An all-age activity, I guess a lifelong activity, not just golf or tennis or now pickleball, but rock climbing too.
Even when I go to the gym myself, I do see a lot of people in older generations.
So most of the people that you do see are, it's more of a hobby or leisure type activity. Not that it's casual, but it's not anybody that you're seeing that is professional, you know, that they're doing this 3, 4, or 5 times a week, or is that the case?
Even if they're not professional, most people are climbing 3 to 4 times a week. There's some professionals, I'd say like a quarter of my clients are professional. Professional being that they compete, not necessarily that they're ranked nationally. Or a lot of them also identify as professional climbers, but they don't necessarily compete. They have careers in mountain guiding is what we call it out here, which is teaching other people to climb or taking more amateur people on like climbing expedition type things. There's a large amount that if it's not their full-time job, they do it on the weekends. So a lot of them will probably self-identify as professional rock climbers.
Could say it's their profession because it's their job.
I have a lot of route setters, which is the people that put the rocks into the wall inside of the gym and then label the level of the climbing. A lot of them are route setters, which is also a career or a part-time career, at least. Usually full-time, actually.
Kara, what are you thinking? Anything else we need to ask?
Emily, is there anything that you specifically would like us to know about?
I think the biggest takeaway that I learned, at least, is to modify ways to climb instead of breaks, even if that's just hangboarding, which is that pull-up bar type thing. Not really a pull-up bar. If you Googled it, you would think I was making things up.
When I was in college, I had several guy friends that got into rock climbing. You go to college and they have it at the rec center. It's free for them to use or whatever. And several of them decided, ooh, I'm going to put one of those in my house. And you know, they all live together and boys in their houses. And they just would sit and have competitions of how long they could hang on that. And they're probably in the basement now and or their kids have found them and they're wanting to try them out now. But yeah, I remember all the guys having those in college.
Funny. Yeah, they're very popular out here. Yeah, I think just that. And then stretching is what I talk about a lot at work. The main questions I get, they're all very interested in their grip strengths and imaging. I have an imaging ultrasound. I don't use it very often. I don't really feel like I need it. But a lot of them will ask me to use it for fun, quote unquote. Like they are very curious. And they like to know exactly when I talk about pulleys and stuff. I bring up a lot of pictures and sometimes we'll ultrasound them. Or I have one really good one from someone else that had a bowstringing rupture of their pulley. So I've saved, obviously don't have the patient information, but I've saved that video and I show it to people and everyone loves it. So definitely a big education piece. And then, yeah, trying to take away from grip strength and talk about how other things, mobility, flexibility are important as well.
What would your most important piece of advice to those of us that are not climbing regularly or have any experience, and two, aren't working specifically in a clinic that predominantly sees climbers, but maybe weekend warrior, someone who does climb a few days a week and they come in with an injury? What would your advice be to us in how to approach these patients and how to get them through their injury and back out in the gym or back outside on the rock?
I think the uniqueness of how they use their hands is important. I think if we ask the population itself that question, they would say that we use our hands differently, or non-climbers use their hands differently, so we wouldn't understand, for lack of a better term. So I think understanding what their grips look like when they're climbing is a big piece to it. If you YouTubed any more than amateur climber, you would probably see it. As hand therapists, we'd be able to see the difference. It's just really relying on extrinsic muscles. Most of what we do is an intrinsic minus position. So we're taking away that mass from the lumbricals, which is a big difference in terms of how we normally death grip things. So I think, yeah, appreciating the uniqueness of how they use their bodies.
Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And this is definitely a specialty area. I'm sure listeners will enjoy the episode.
Sweet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Hands in Motion, brought to you by the American Society of Hand Therapists. You can listen on the ASHT website and or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple, Google, Amazon Music, and Spotify. Once subscribed, please rate and review the podcast to help us reach new listeners and to continue offering valuable, relevant content.
You've been listening to Hands in Motion, brought to you by the American Society of Hand Therapists. To learn more about ASHT and to subscribe to the show, please visit ASHT.org. We'll see you next time on the Hands in Motion podcast.